Hello, this is Brian Madden. Today is my birthday, Thursday, December 14th, 2006, and you're listening to Brian Madden Live. I just got back last night from 2 days of recording interviews at Citrix's Fort Lauderdale headquarters. Today I'm happy to share my conversation with Brad Peterson, Citrix's chief architect. He's been with the company 17 years and seen the evolution of today's presentation server product since the very beginning. In today's show, Brad shares the technical history of presentation server. This includes how it came to be, how ICA and IMA were created, and where he hopes to take the product in the future. I sat down with Brad in his office.
Well, my name is Brad Peterson. I'm chief architect for Citrix. Been with the company for 17 years. I'll be coming up my anniversary date in, I guess, another week or so.
So this company even existed 17 years ago?
It's pretty small back then. We were a startup. There was approximately 10 of us. There was actually, out of IBM, we came in like two batches. There were seven folks that came out of IBM. Let me roll back a little bit, first of all. I mean, if I roll back, Ed Yacobucci, and Randy Wood basically went and they did the initial, they founded the company, and they raised the initial venture capital. It was all VC funded in the early days, and they incubated the company, and that took about 6 months, and they did that, I believe, in Texas. And once they had the initial funding and the money, then they needed to hire the initial employees, and almost all but one of those initial employees came out of IBM Boca. And so those employees, it was the group I was working in. I was an architect at IBM for a brief period of time. And those employees out of IBM, friends with Ed, personal acquaintances, and I knew these. I didn't know Ed at the time, but I knew these other folks. And they told me they were leaving IBM to join this company, and they couldn't tell me anything about it. It was hush-hush secret, big secret, but they said you should check it out, and I said, yeah, I'm interested, without having any idea what it was about. And so I had an interview, and it was a lunch, I believe it was at Bennigan's, with Ed, and we just met and chit-chatted, over lunch. And a day later, I got an offer, and a week later, it was about 2 weeks, I think, I joined the company. I had to give my couple-week notice at IBM. And IBM was actually kind of pissed off that all these folks were leaving and going to go with Ed. Ed used to be at IBM, and Ed wanted to build basically the product multi-user OS2 at IBM, but IBM wasn't interested. I think they were afraid it was going to compete against their mid-market AS400s and so forth. So they wanted OS2 to be a single-user system. So Ed left IBM. Ultimately started Citrix. Well, we were called Citrus then, like the fruit, like the orange. It wasn't we actually had we used the name Citrus for I think about 6 months, or it was less than a year. And then we originally came up with the name Citrix. And a little bit on the name. The name was actually, we went back and forth. We hired this outside consulting agent to come up with a name, and they came up with all kinds of crazy names.
Is this after you had the name Citrus? Yeah. And they were trying to change it, pick a new name? Yeah.
Yep. They were trying to pick a new name. There was issues with Citrus. I think there were some trademarks. I mean, well, it's a fruit, too. It's a problem in itself. So they hired some expensive, folks to try to come up with a better name, and they failed. Eventually, I think someone inside the company came up with Citrix, because it was kind of a combination of Citrus with Unix. Is kind of where, and we were initially targeting to go after SCO in the SCO business. SCO had a lot of small business, and we were creating this multi-user OS2 to go after SCO. That's really where the Citrix name came from. So when we joined, like I said, there was 12 of us in the company at that time, almost all engineering, and we had a license for OS2 through Microsoft. We actually got a IBM really didn't want to talk to us in those days because they were kind of angry that all these people had left.
Yeah.
Eventually they got over it, but it took quite a few years. But we got the license to OS2 source code through Microsoft, and we set out. We did what we did when we made OS2 multi-user. Basically, you know, all the folks were very familiar with OS2. They all came out of Boca was the location. You know, all the OS2 work was being done. So all the original Citrix folks were very familiar with OS2 internals, and they were, you know, we had a lot of internal, you know, operating system type people who were quite familiar. So we had kind of a head start. We kind of understood how it worked, and we knew what we wanted to do. And so we set out to do that, and we initially made the changes, and we eventually shipped, or we got to a point where we got something up and running, and we did our first trade show at Comdex. In retrospect, the Comdex show wasn't any big hit, but it was our first coming out party, if you will, first time we'd ever talked about the product publicly. We got some people interested in it. The bottom line is that first product, it was called Multi-User, never was successful. We sold some, but certainly not enough to sustain a company. And I mean, if you really had to judge it, it was a failure, that first product. But we listened to customers and what they wanted, and they wanted things like this. By the way, this first product, Multi-User, was a Multi-User OS2 with dumb terminals. Okay, so serial connected, RS-232, dumb terminals like VT100 televideo. Okay, we didn't have our own protocol. We didn't have anything at that point. It was you know, just using standard serial connections, running OS2 text-based apps. So it was all five of them. It was pretty. it never went anywhere. But we listened to customers, and the types of things they were asking for is, you know, Windows was catching on. Microsoft, you know, had Windows 3.0 and 3.1. DOS obviously was very popular in those days. So we added DOS support. We added Windows support. They wanted, you know, dial-up remote access. So we added modem support so you could dial up remotely. And things were finally starting to come together, to gel a little bit. You know, customers, this remote access angle actually proved to be the hook. That's what really caused things to be successful, is the fact that we could start dialing up remotely. We created the first ICA protocol. Okay, and ICA, we had to create our own protocol because we were remoting Windows. Okay, so we had this OS2 box running virtual DOS machine and VDM. It's a virtual DOS machine VDM, but it basically was OS2 that you could boot a DOS image in it, or it included a DOS image, and within that you could then install Windows 3.1, and it was a customized version of Windows 3.1. And you could then run pretty much any DOS app or any Windows app. And we needed to create our own ICA protocol because up to that point we were just using dumb terminals and they were all text-based, so we needed something that supported graphics. So we, in the early, so never done this, you know, and the connectivity was pretty slow back in those days. I mean, the dial-up modems were 9600 baud. So you think of trying to run a remote Windows session over that today, it'd be a bit of a stretch. So we didn't really know if it was even doable, although there was about a half a dozen remote control products out there. The PC Anywhere was obviously, you know, in the market. There was another product called ReachOut, sold by a company called Ocean Isle. I have no idea what happened to the company. But Citrix licensed the remoting protocol from Ocean Isle, the original ICA remoting, what we call ThinWire. So it's the graphics remoting protocol. Now, that's no longer, I mean, that's long ago. But that was the first graphics remoting protocol. And then we crafted the ICA 1.0, we called it.
Where did ICA come from?
The acronym. I mean, initially it was Intelligent Console Architecture. Okay. What is it now?
Independent Computing Architecture.
Yeah. That got changed halfway after a couple of years. Someone decided. So Ed Yacobucci made up the name. That's where the name came from. I don't know where he got it, but Intelligent Console Architecture sounded cool at the time. And
this is, what, 93, 94?
Yeah, good question. This would have been exactly 93, 94, probably 93. Yeah, plus or minus a year. So we had to create the first ICA client. Since we had this protocol now, we had to have a client that understood it. And then the corresponding server-side code. And we targeted initially, it was, again, serial connections and modems. Modems. Networking was just, it wasn't all that popular back then. I mean, there was some token ring in there. I mean, it was emerging. But it wasn't anywhere near like it is today. The DigiBoard, I don't know if you've ever heard of...
Yeah, the dial-in, of course.
Yeah, DigiBoard, Stargate, these boards you plug into your computer that provided 16 modems off the back.
Yeah.
That was the way it was done.
And I set up projects myself using Cubix hardware, is the original Blades.
Yep.
With these DigiBoards and using one-to-one PC Anywhere. So it's a bank of like 32
yep.
Windows machines, and you just dial in, the phone system rolls you over to the next empty one, and you latch on via PC Anywhere to full remote control 386.
So very much, I mean, that was, it was that space, that use case that we were going after, but in a much more user-friendly and admin-friendly packaging. Because that, I'm sure, was kind of a nightmare to set up and configure and maintain.
I absolutely remember that, going through one by one and basically booting these off the CD or floppy disk piles or whatever, and basically installing 32 copies of DOS, 32 copies of Windows, 32 copies of PC Anywhere. Absolutely manually, one by one by one.
Funny, the world is coming back to that again.
With BDI.
That's what I find is big cycles. Repeating history, just changing a few things.
But it's new people repeating it, so they don't realize the downfalls each time.
Absolutely. Yep. So we created, we basically had a product that now allowed you to dial up over modem, and it was 9600 baud that eventually migrated to 19.2, I guess, baud modems. And we did a deal with Novell to we integrated the Novell redirector requester, so we could basically dial in and access Novell networks. Okay, so now we could run pretty much all of the standard Novell apps, the DOS apps, the Windows apps, but we could do it remotely. So we came up, and that was WinView, or initially A-plus Remote, and it went through a lot of different names. But WinView is where it settled. The name we stuck with WinView. And that was the first successful product of the company. And it was sold as a remote access product, remote access for Novell networks. And it was very popular. It did did what we said it would. You could run any of your Novell applications remotely, and it became pretty popular. We also, in about that time frame, we added TCP/IP. Up to that point, TCP/IP was not included with OS, with the operating system. We licensed that from FTP software, and that was included with the operating system or with WinView. And we at that bought. In that time frame, we created the first network client, base client. The very first one we did was NetBIOS or NetBUI. We called that LANlink. But it was we had one client that was focused on the LAN network called LANlink, and the serial one was called RLink, Remote Link. And that evolved. We added TCP/IP support to it, so it supported NetBUI. TCP/IP, and then we added, it was sometime later, we added SPX, although I don't know if we ever shipped SPX in WinView. In any case, about this time frame, we were all getting kind of disillusioned with OS2. OS2 wasn't going anywhere. And so we decided we really needed to switch over to NT. And we were familiar with NT because while at IBM, we'd worked with Microsoft on NT. In fact, about half of us, about six of us at that time at Citrix, had directly worked or gotten briefed and did a lot of. IBM was trying to figure out what the next generation was after OS2, and one of the options they were looking at was, should IBM adopt NT as the follow-on to OS2? Well, they decided not to. they end up doing Warp instead. But yeah, wrong answer. but it gave us about six, like I said, about six of us that ultimately went to Citrix an opportunity to really to get to know NT, because we traveled to Redmond a dozen times probably and met with Dave Cutler and the original NT team and got architectural briefings and basically inside look at how NT worked and how it was put together through all these briefings from Microsoft, because obviously Microsoft was trying to convince IBM that this is the wave of the future.
Well, they convinced in their advantage to share as much as they possibly could with you guys.
Absolutely, that was very true, and that's what they did. And well, they convinced us.
You couldn't convince IBM, so you
Wasn't the reason we left IBM, but ultimately, though, it was just it was coincidence. I don't know, fate, that it was the same folks that had been involved with that at IBM that ultimately ended up at Citrix. Because now we were at Citrix, and we knew, you know, this NT thing was happening at Microsoft. And so Ed Yacobucci had all these contacts at Microsoft. He went back to Microsoft and negotiated a source license to NT. By the way, we had a source license to Windows, too, Windows 3.1. So we had a source license for DOS, Windows, OS 2, and NT. So, you know, we had plenty of source. And so we got an NT source license, and it was a unique license. It allowed us to do derivative products. In other words, we could make changes to it and reship it as a Citrix product. And I think there was only one other license like that Microsoft did. I don't even know who it was, too. But it was a pretty special license. It was unique. And Microsoft would never do it again, obviously. Any sort of derivative. You know, they're really tightly controlling. They want one version of Windows for good reason. So we got that source code, and we, like three of us, it was myself and Mike Descavage was the other guy that was heavily involved, and John Richardson, and I'm probably leaving out, but there was a small set of us, like three of us initially, and we spent months basically pouring through the source code trying to figure out, okay, how do we make this multi-user? Because we didn't have any docs, we didn't have any specs, we didn't have anything, just the source code.
We had the faint memory of David Cutler.
Yeah.
I couldn't even imagine how many lines of code it was, hundreds of thousands, millions, whatever.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, here we go. And
so we did things like, you know, we installed it and then using a debugger, you know, stepped through what it did when it booted and what it did when it launched and apps and, you know, figuring out how...
Well, so the word reverse engineering has bad connotations today socially. But for all intents and purposes,
it was. But we had a legal license to do so.
Right.
In this case.
And they said, "Yeah, what you want to do sounds cool. Here's all the code. Yep. Good luck with that.
You're kind of on your own." You know, they were just covering their bets. You know, they were in Microsoft was in a position where brand new thing, NT at this point it hadn't even shipped. Okay, I mean it hadn't even gotten in the market yet. So they were covering their bets. They knew the Unix and SCO and everything else was still going on. You know, it was competition to this NT thing. So they figured, well, if Citrix can succeed with a multi-user version, that'll just help our cause.
And if they fail, no harm, no foul.
No, yeah, exactly. And, I mean, that's what happened. Although I think we succeeded a little too well, or more than what Microsoft anticipated. But we eventually figured out how to do that. And at the same time, we decided, okay, we really needed to do this ICA protocol over again. Because what we had done with the OS2-based product was a hack. I mean, it really was. I mean, the problem with the OS2 product was, well, we started with the licensed remoting protocol, the Ocean Isle. But then we glued on client drive mapping. This is back in the WinView product, by licensing this crazy, this Novell. It was called Serview. But it was a mini Novell file server that we embedded into the ICA client. I kid you not. And it was IPX based. And so you had to have IPX to use to do client drive mapping because it created, it advertised itself as a Novell file server.
Right, only to the one, the client in that case was your WinView server through your session.
That's right, exactly, which is very, we had client printing, a very early version. Remember, this is all in IPX. IPX being a datagram protocol, so it's not reliable. So we had to do our own reliable protocol on top of it, sliding window retransmission and all that protocol. And the trouble was we did this very piecemeal. We did one thing, and then a customer would say, wouldn't it be great if you did this? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So we added that, and we added. And it didn't really, by the time we were done, it was this messy glob of code. And that was the original ICA. So now we're going to do NT, and we said, we can do this much, much better. And so let me, ICA, I'll just give a little review. I mean, ICA is a remoting protocol. Okay, so it's how we connect the client to the server. ICA has today, today's ICA has multiple virtual channels. Each virtual channel is a protocol in itself. So there's one protocol for client drive mapping, one for printing, one for smart card, one for graphics, and so forth. And right now I forget how many we have, but we probably have approaching 25 of them, I think, approximately. And then third parties can create their own channels also. So we have a virtual channel SDK. The client, we wanted a modular client architecture. And by that I mean, in those days, there was no clear winner who was going to win. I mean, there was TCP, there was IPX, there was SPX, there was NetBIOS, there was modem still, there were serial connection, direct serial connections. So we needed to support them all. Okay, so we came up with a modular layered architecture for ICA. You know, we had this transport driver at the bottom, which, talked to either IPX, whatever the underlying networking or serial protocol was. Then we had, layered on top of that, we had protocol drivers that were layered. So we had a kind of a layered architecture. We layer on error correction. So if you're running over a modem or a serial connection, we had to do our own error correction. Or if you're running on a datagram protocol like IPX, we added our own error correction. We had to add framing. If you're on TCP, TCP is a streaming protocol, so there's no concept of a frame. So you don't know, if you send 100 bytes, the client may receive it as 10 byte reads. You lose the fact that here's a 100 byte packet that you want to interpret as a 100 byte packet on the client side. So you actually had to add frame headers so you could frame it. You had to add error detection. Some of the protocols weren't reliable. Like a serial connection could drop one bit in the middle of something, so you had to see it. Whereas if you're running a TCP, it had error correction. So you kind of built up this matrix. Some protocols did error correction, some didn't. Some had stream, some didn't. Some had frame, some didn't. So we came up with an ICA protocol that you could layer the appropriate, what we call protocol drivers, to add the missing piece. So we could add error correction, we can add a frame header.
At the end of the day, the baseline that you're going to lay your virtual channels on, it's the same regardless of the actual networking protocol.
That's exactly right.
Because your functionality is not built into the network.
So we hit all that complexity, and just like you said, we could now write a virtual channel assuming that it was a framed, reliable connection, okay, that preserved frame boundaries and that always delivered the data. So if you wrote 100 bytes, the client would receive 100 bytes. And all the complexities were then, totally hidden. And that's what we designed. So we designed the ICA protocol stack with, to handle that layering. And then you could negotiate in things like encryption or compression. We didn't always, in those early days, we've evolved our compression a lot since in those days. But it was an optional layer back in the original architecture. And I designed... That was really one of the aspects that I designed the majority, that architecture for the ICA protocol and the client, the ICA client, and that's what we continue to use that same architecture in today's products. The difference being now that the world's much easier, simpler today. It's TCP, and that's all people care about. So basically, we no longer support all that other complexity. We no longer have to do our own error correction. We don't have to, it's just TCP, and we optimize around TCP nowadays. But that was not the case when WinFrame was originally created, which was the first NT-based product. So the beauty of, going back to the WinFrame now, we decided that we wanted to re-implement all this for all the reasons I just outlined. And the beauty of it was that since we'd already done it on the OS2-based product, on the WinView product, we knew what we needed. Okay, so we had the requirements. when we design when I when I created this architecture, I knew what the requirements were. That wasn't the case, you know, a year, 2 years prior, because we were just kind of evolving based on customer requirements. But at this point, we'd evolved something that was pretty useful. And so when we built WinFrame and the ICA 2.0 protocol, that's what we called it, we kind of knew what we were doing. I mean, we knew what the end game was. We didn't always know what we were doing, but we knew what we had the requirements. I'll put it that way. And that helped a lot, since we were now able to build an architecture that was flexible enough to continue to evolve. I mean, it's evolved now, I don't know how many years. That was about 95, so it's evolved 11 years, you know, going on 12 years, and it's still the same foundation there. So we created the ICA protocol. We had just a couple of virtual channels back in those days. We created the first version of ThinWire version 1. We're on version 2 of ThinWire right now. So ThinWire is the remoting protocol of ICA. And the way that works is on the server, so on the NT box, we replace the video driver. Okay, so our interception point is at the video driver. So we have a custom video driver that typically, for review, the video driver typically talks to the locally attached device, you know, the display, locally attached display. And so when a Windows application runs, it uses the GDI APIs, the command set. The GDI ultimately call the video driver. Okay, and the video driver has a bunch of primitives that it understands, and they're types of things like there's a bit blit, you know, for displaying a bitmap. There's draw line, there's fill region, there's, you know, display font, display, you know, character, and probably dozens of others. I'm not an expert on the video driver by any means, because we have quite a few experts that are much smarter in that area than I am. But the point is that it's kind of low-level drawing primitives that the video driver sees. And the ThinWire protocol essentially remotes those primitives to the client. So when there's a draw line, we figure out what's the best way to represent that in a command packet. We create that command packet. We send that command packet to the client, and then we interpret it on the client, and then call the corresponding GDI operations on the client. And so, in essence, we're kind of, it's almost like remoting, you know, the app calls a line draw GDI operation on the server, and on the client, we end up calling the same line draw on the client.
Yeah, so it's not the phrase screen scraping
is not
maybe not the most correct phrase, because you're not looking at pixels as they're coming out of the frame buffer, per se. You're sort of one step earlier than that.
Yep. We're quite a bit earlier. I mean, to contrast that, Citrix actually has a product that does screen scraping, and that's Citrix Online with the GoToMyPC. Okay, GoToMyPC is just, it's an application that runs in the remote PC that you want to connect to, and it does screen scraping. And screen scraping, the technical description of screen scraping is that it scrapes, it basically reads the bits, the bitmap off the screen that's currently being displayed. So it's all at a bitmap level. And it's harder to be optimal because you're dealing with a bitmap. By that time, you've lost, you know, you don't have any visibility, you know, of text. Everything's just a bitmap.
Yeah.
You don't have any visibility of, you know, what was a line, what was a fill, what was, you know, any of the primitives. And so you have to use differential approaches and then compress the hell out of things.
It's like a movie codec, really, at that point.
Yeah. But it's trickier than movies, too, because movies can blur. And if you ever pause a movie, it's not very sharp. And if you tried that with a window or a Windows application, you wouldn't be able to read the text. So you can't use it. In some ways, it is similar, but it's a harder problem. So going back to what we do in Presentation Server, which is the current product with ICA, is we are sending these low-level primitives, and it actually gives us a lot of opportunity to optimize. So we we've spent a lot of time. We're actually, the graphics remoting protocol is actually, we're on our third generation. Okay, so we've done this three times. So the very first one was licensed, okay, and then we did improvements on that even back in the OS2 timeframe. Then we redid it for the first version of WinFrame. Okay, and then a couple of releases later, we redid it again. We threw away what we did with WinFrame, and we redid it again.
This is why if you look at the Citrix connection configuration, it shows 3.0 is the ICA version.
Yep, and the graphics protocol, it really defines that, among other things, defines the experience, you know, how well you do in remoting the graphics. And there's a lot of, we end up doing a lot of other tricks, caching, compression, both of those are very important in order to get a good experience. We do a lot of special processing in how we buffer, in ICA today, we're measuring the round trip time between the server and the client, we're measuring bandwidth, and the protocol dynamically adjusts according to those measurements to try to optimize the user experience. So what you do on a high bandwidth, you know, LAN connection is very different than what you do on a slower narrow pipe, you know, like a WAN or even a satellite. Although satellites are kind of unique because they're high bandwidth but high latency. So you got to kind of balance out the bandwidth with the latency and how you generate the protocol. So ICA remains, you know, continues to be an important area for Citrix as far as we've really been able to leverage that to extend the user experience. In other words, what we like to call local remote transparency between the client and the server. A lot of that has to do with, you know, seamless windows is an obvious example, but things like client, you know, printing, trying to get that printing experience to be as seamless as possible, as transparent. You know, our goal is to build so when a user is running an app, they don't know it's remote. I mean, if we can achieve that, then we've succeeded. But it's more than just the graphics. It's all these other things too. And we you know, there's still things we plan to do or continue and improve that user experience.
Well, and so you had taken us through the development and got us through WinFrame, and then sort of did things need to change much? I mean, once Microsoft decided that they were doing terminal services themselves in the NT4 range, but then there's still the source code agreement where you get the source code back again. So was that from a technical standpoint, was that just kind of business as usual for what you guys needed to do, or did that change the game for how the product worked?
So NT4. If you think back, remember back, Microsoft actually did some significant changes. They used to have a lot of stuff running up in user land, and they pushed the GDI into the kernel, and they pushed the video drivers used to be up in the user level, and they pushed the video drivers and the printer drivers into the kernel. This is when they did the big shuffle to try to improve the performance. And we had all the beta versions of NT4, you know, so we were changing our architecture to match the new model. And we had all of them running. We hadn't shipped yet. The problem at that point in time, we didn't have a license of NT4. In other words, we had the license, you know, the beta was fine, but we didn't have a license to ship a product based on NT4 yet. The source code license agreement we had did not cover NT4. And it was in this time frame that Microsoft decided that, well, maybe Citrix is getting too successful. I think they got concerned of this alternative version of NT out there in the market and losing control of that. And, you know, if Citrix didn't, we were having to merge service packs and hot fixes and all that, so we were having to maintain that, which was actually a pain in the neck because we were spending a lot of our support.
To maintain their code, their OS, really.
Yeah, because any customer who found a problem, it was a Citrix problem. I mean, it still is that way. But
by that time, it really was.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And so we had to fix even, you know, NT kernel problems. So we had a lot of kernel expertise in-house at that point in time, and we were spending a lot of our cycles just fixing NT. And it was hard to keep up to date, too, because there was a lag. Microsoft released a service pack hotfix, and we had to merge it back into our code, which was slightly different, so we had to go through a merge process. And so Microsoft, I think, I haven't heard the rationale from Microsoft, but I'm just guessing, this is just my opinion, that Microsoft, number one, we were starting to generate a fair amount of revenue based on this alternative version of NT. Number two, Microsoft kind of lost control of that, so they wanted to pull back control. In any case, they announced to the world that they were not renewing our license, and that they had just purchased a French company called Prolog, that was one of our early competitors. They hadn't been too successful in the market, but they also that was the other company. They had created a multi-user NT also, and Microsoft purchased the entire company along with all the assets and moved all the Prolog engineers to Redmond. And so basically they announced they did this in a press announcement. I mean, they had to do a press announcement because Citrix was a public company at the time.
Yeah, so they announced that they were buying your competitor.
Yep.
And not going to give you a source code license.
Right. Basically, that's it.
Yeah.
That day, the Citrix stock, price, fell, obviously, down to, I forget what it was, but it was something ridiculous, $5 or something. It went way down. Okay. It caught us by surprise because, we didn't have, at least I don't believe we had any forewarning that this was about to happen when it happened. But basically we went and camped out on Microsoft's doorstep for the next 3 months, okay? We rented some apartments in Redmond. At this time, we didn't have a Redmond office. We were just located here in Fort Lauderdale. We rented some condos or apartments in Redmond, a mile or two from, and started demanding meetings with Microsoft. And Ed Iacobucci and the guy at Barry Davis was kind of our head negotiator. Very good. And our goal was to convince Microsoft that they needed us, that we did it right, that this Prolog approach wasn't going to work, or wasn't as good.
And this is the terminal services capabilities that they wanted to build into NT was based on the Prolog stuff.
Yep. And obviously this was before terminal servers existed, because this is all the beginning of terminal server. But yes, originally their plans were to use the Prolog code to implement what we know as terminal services.
Okay.
Yep, exactly. We did have some patents pending at the time, so that probably helped. Okay, it was just more pros on our side. We went at this time we didn't have anything to lose from a company standpoint, so we opened the Komodo. We went there and we did I went there, a bunch of the engineers. We did pitches. We went, they were willing to listen. I mean, Microsoft was. So we basically went and presented our architecture and how it worked and what we did, how we made Windows multi-user, and the approach that we took and everything, and we presented it and in the end we convinced them that they should license the code from Citrix, and they did, and they licensed the code from Citrix. We did a quick split, because remember, up to that point we had we had WinFrame, which is one product,
right? Microsoft OS plus the Citrix.
Yeah, it was plus the Citrix stuff plus all our other value add. Microsoft wanted the ICA protocol, but we felt we had to hold back something. So we held back ICA, we held back load balancing, the farm, the concept of the farm. Now, remember back in we just had the ICA browser, so it was pretty primitive. This was before IMA, before we really had the farm built out. But we did have load balancing through the ICA browser, we had the ICA protocol, and that's about all we had. So we said we wanted to keep that. We had needed to keep something. And we licensed or sold basically primarily the multi-user changes we made to the kernel. Okay. And we had to do a quick split. we had to quickly figure out, since we weren't giving him ICA, we had to, like in a matter of a couple of weeks, design the interface of how ICA plugged into terminal services and how RDP ultimately would plug in.
Because that was going to be next month what you could plug it into.
Yes. So we've been struggling. You know, that's been an interesting issue ongoing. We've been cleaning those interfaces up jointly with Microsoft ever since. They're slowly getting okay. So we signed this deal, and we gave them this source drop. We kept, you know, our part, and then we had quickly, I think we codenamed it Picasso.
I remember it was called Picasso, and I thought that was a way cooler name than MetaFrame. I remember my colleagues in Cleveland, Ohio, Lynn Fetzko, and I, saw Picasso, and we were playing with it, and it was cool, and then the product came out, it was called MetaFrame, and we were
that is a cool name. Actually, we tried. Picasso was kind of taken.
I hadn't heard of that before.
There's some trademarks there. I think we seriously did look at Picasso, I think we might even got in trouble for publicly talking about Picasso because of trademark issues. I don't remember for sure. Microsoft codenamed their side Hydra. And that was the beginning of Terminal Server. Now, Terminal Server, the first version of Terminal Server is Terminal Server Edition, NT4.0 Terminal Server Edition. And that was created primarily by Citrix. Okay, there was a joint development agreement between the companies, and Citrix did most of the effort to get to that, to the point that Microsoft did the final testing, basically the quality assurance.
And this is based on the code that you developed before, but now sort of packaging it into a Microsoft branded, when you separated your product, basically separated out, you took this part of theirs and helped them reintegrate it in and build all those interfaces and make that happen.
Yep. And that's basically, what we know of as of Terminal Server today, or Terminal Services. And that code ultimately made its way into Windows XP and for remote desktop, the underlying term serve, and the protocol architecture. Now, obviously, Microsoft plugged in, their protocol, the RDP protocol, into that architecture. And then we plugged the ICA. The fast user switching is basically just switching between terminal server sessions on a Windows XP box. I mean, it's the same technology. Now, obviously, it's evolved over the years, and Microsoft's not standing still with it. But that was its the birth. The beginning was all based on the Citrix code that was used for Terminal Server. And so, yeah, Microsoft ultimately it was a separate edition for 4.0. It eventually got integrated into 2000 Win2K. It's just a mode of that you could turn on or off, and it's still in Longhorn. We're working joint collaboration with Microsoft now today on the Longhorn version to making sure that it's the best terminal server platform for both companies. Make sure that presentation server works well on it, as well as, or if not better than previous platforms.
So as you were working in Picasso, codename turned into MetaFrame, and then MetaFrame 1.0, and then we had MetaFrame 1.8, which I think maybe added program neighborhood at that time and that kind of stuff. And then going to XP was a pretty big change, though.
Yeah, XP is really where up to that point, we were starting to kind of limp along on the ICA browser. And the ICA browser was one of the... There's only a few pieces of code that I can really point to that I wrote. I mean, I had my fingers in a lot of things and, all the original multi-user work. But I wrote the ICA browser from the ground up. I shouldn't even admit that because you can throw that thing away. But it's not
but
used.
The ICA browser, I think, fell down in larger environments.
Yes.
But I'm guessing you didn't write the ICA browser for people that had 25 servers talking to each other.
No, it was for a small farm, small cluster of servers. And it became, how we did load balancing and how we basically did the app publishing and app enumeration across those servers. Each server would tell the browser what apps were available on it. the ICA client would talk to the browser to get the list of apps, and then do the name resolution, which did actually the name resolution is load balancing. So you say, the client would say, I want to run, you know, Word. It would talk to the browser, and the browser would figure out which server was least loaded based on the most recent statistics it gotten from the servers, and then return the IP or the address of the server back to the client. The client would then connect to that server. So that was really the beginning of how we did a farm. But it didn't scale. It used UDP, which had issues too, because people were trying to use it across WANs and
firewalls,
and obviously, I mean, a lot of issues with that. We had, at the same time, we had the program neighborhood. I forget what it was called, but it was a service that ran on each server that kind of dealt with a published app, and it was a peer-to-peer, so every server had to talk to every other server, which obviously doesn't scale because it's kind of a star network. And it just, after the farm got so big, that kind of collapsed under its own weight also. Excuse me. So we knew we had to do something there. That was really where IMA came from. We decided we need to have some more standardized plumbing or how we communicated between the servers. We decided we need to go to a central data store. Up to that point, the administrative tool just kind of poked config into each server.
And every server stored its own configuration, its own registry.
Exactly. So it was hard to, you know, manageability was a bit to be desired. So we started working in IMA, and as you mentioned, this is part of XP, and it was actually, it was a big change. I mean, we did it pretty much in all one fall swoop. And in retrospect, it probably would have been better to do in several incremental releases. Because we ended up writing the IMA service, the data store, the whole set of systems, the data collector, all the subsystems that we did, all in one fall swoop. I mean, and it took longer than we anticipated. I bet we were about a year later than we thought we were going to be as far as getting that out. We had to delay the release and everything.
It was, I think that was an early 2001 release, whereas Windows 2000 itself had come out in early 2000. So it was probably about a year after that Windows 2000 came out that XP came out.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad we did it. If we hadn't done it, we'd had to do something.
Well, and even to this day, really, I mean, I think the changes from XP to PS3, 4, and then 4.5 are not probably as great architecturally.
No, they're not. That was our, and we're looking at, you know, future stuff, and maybe we'll come back to that, you know, how we evolve the architecture on a go-forward basis. But IMA was a big step forward. You know, in retrospect, you always look back and, you know, I would have done that a little different if I would do it again. And I think that's always true when you look back. Very rarely you'll say that's perfect because it's not. Whenever you develop software in particular, you always got to do trade-offs. I mean, that's actually part of being an architect. The architect role at Citrix is that we're very involved in deciding trade-offs because you can never do everything that you want to do. You can never do it in the ideal way. You always got to figure out what kind of trade-offs, what do we not do, you know, where do we focus, what do we cut back on, and, you know, what gives us the biggest bang for the buck. And that's really, at Citrix, that's really one of the major roles of an architect is to make those trade-off decisions. But with IMA, we initially started out a little more ambitious. This is one of the things I would do differently. It was initially developed to be cross-platform. In other words, we wanted it portable to non-Windows platforms. Okay. We never did that, obviously. I mean, we only support IMA on Windows. We also wanted, initially it was, the IMA internal architecture was LDAP-based. Okay. We ultimately ended up using a database. And that's why the database is the way it is. You know, it's data blobs. It's not a nice database schema like you would.
If you open it within SQL, you don't see hundreds of tables and a fully normalized database.
We're not using it in the as a relational database, which if we were to do it again, we would. Okay, but the reason was is because we originally designed IMA with the concept of LDAP using an LDAP store, and LDAP is not a relational database, so we ended up, and then we ended up morphing, ended up deciding to go with the database, SQL or Oracle. And but it was too late in the design, so we were stuck with this LDAP stuff.
Okay, so this is a key point, is that Citrix did not use these binary blob elements in the data store just to screw people who had to support it 10 years later.
No. In fact, we regret it from... I'd love to be able to go back and fix that, and we'll figure out. I mean, that's part of the how we evolve, you know, presentation server in the future, is how we straighten this out. You know, data store being one of the key areas, because we would love to be able to use more traditional, you know, relational database, traditional, you know, tables and so
and
forth.
Just for replication and backup and fixing and auditing, all that stuff kind of unwinds.
All those standard reasons. Yeah, absolutely. No, it was, it's the way it is today, because of history. I mean, just how things kind of evolved as far as the data store goes. The other important part of IMA is the dynamic store, okay, the data collector concept. That was really kind of an evolution of the ICA browser. You can kind of see the it's similar in concept. An alternative would be to use a database and to have every server kind of keep a central database up to date. You know, every time the load changed or whatever, you'd poke the database with a new record. We decided against that from a scalability standpoint, because we'd end up generating an awful lot of transactions against a common database. And then at the time, we also didn't want to have to require a database to always be, you know, that connectivity that would require. So we went with the data collector model, which is essentially an in-memory database. I mean,
it's got tables.
It has tables, exactly. Yeah. We can add new tables, new records to that store, and we have. And really, you know, when necessary, it has the master. You know, there's an election process where we divide a farm into zones. Each zone, the reason we did zones was the idea there was that the assumption was a zone was highly connected from a networking standpoint, so it was on LAN, and in practice you don't. Although there are reasons to do so, we didn't want zones spanning a WAN. Okay, and the concept was that you'd have a zone; it would have its own data collector, master data collectors. So a zone would keep itself up to date of what's going on within that zone, and a second zone would do the same within its zone, and then the two zones would share the information between themselves as appropriate. Initially, the early architecture for IMA was zones were a little more independent. What ended up happening in the first release, what we've lived with ever since, is that, you know, zone, we've changed this a little bit in more recent releases, but for several releases, every zone shared all data with all other zones. And it was a little excessive. There were cases where that wasn't appropriate. We tried to back off a little bit of that. It's not the easiest, because there are legit reasons you need access to that data, and if you always had to reach across to a remote zone, that has a lot of performance penalties also. So there's some balances there to try to keep the data local to the servers that need the data, essentially, and reduce how much traffic. Because the idea is that a zone may be separated by a WAN, and it could be a slower operation to go between the zones. And then we've kind of used the zone. The zones have kind of morphed into sites, for good or bad. In retrospect, I would have liked to have a separate concept called site that was independent from zones.
Whereas the site would be more specifically based on network topography, and the zone could be a little bit more logically based as far as users and access.
Yep. And it would have just made things a little cleaner, a little more easier from an administrative standpoint, because sites would then match, Active Directory sites, and you could kind of lay it out the same. You know, if you've already decided what your sites are, you could kind of leverage that knowledge. And, you know, we're still looking at, you know, if we can leverage that more in the future. And Active Directory, I mean, when we started, Active Directory didn't exist. I mean, it was all in, you know, all the old NT domains. And Active Directory is getting more and more prevalent in the you know, enterprises, so we'd like to leverage that more and more on a go-forward basis also. Because, you know, if a company's gone through the effort to deploy, you know, Active Directory, they've solved a lot of these issues, replication and sites and so forth, OUs, you know, as much as possible, we should be leveraging those, that data that's already exists there.
Well, sounds like there's a lot, even though Presentation Server has a long history, there's still a lot coming.
Yeah.
A lot more to do and a lot to keep you busy for the next 18 years.
Huh? never a shortage of things on the wish list. I guess that's why it continues to be interesting, is that, you know, there's always challenges, always something new. You know, if it was just rehashing the same thing over and over again, I wouldn't be here anymore. I mean, you got to keep things challenging, keep things interesting, and that's how you keep the good. You know, that's what keeps the engineers interested. They love, you know, I love solving problems, working on problems, and so do most developers. So, yeah. Yep. The last few years have been very interesting. You know, with the we're branching out, obviously different product groups, but even within VSG, you know, to Tarpon and...
Hang on, VSG.
VSG, yeah, I throw out acronyms. Virtualization Systems Group. So VSG is the core presentation server. It's the original group within Citrix. So it's the group that owns Presentation Server, Password Manager, Tarpon, which is the Citrix streaming server, Trinity, which is the Citrix desktop server. So those products are owned by the VSG group. In contrast with ANG, ANG is the networking group, which owns NetScaler, Access Gateway, WANscaler, the networking, really the networking-based products. Those are the two. There's some other groups too, but those are the two big.
VSG has certainly, now that I think the industry all at once almost is starting to think more about what it means to deliver applications and what a desktop means. So it keeps, even as Presentation Server itself, while there's still lots of improvements, mm-hmm. it's a very mature product, but there's still lots of stuff in VSG keeping you busy.
No, absolutely. I mean, the whole, we're still, you know, we've recently, Citrix has started talking about application delivery, okay? Because that's what it's all really what it's all about, and there's multiple ways that you can get your applications. Presentation Server is one of those, you know, based on Terminal Server. The application streaming is another, you know, so where you basically stream the application to the end user on demand as the user runs the application, and then it gets cached, never gets installed. And the hosted desktop, which is basically moving your, the simple way to think of it is moving the office PCs into the data center. And then you may or may not use thin clients. I mean, you don't have to use thin clients, but it's basically centralizing the desktops into the data center. And all three approaches have their merits. And those data centers, on the hosted desktop, those desktops may or may not be running on top of a virtualization layer, like virtual PC, or, you know, either Microsoft or VMware virtualization. And that's certainly getting a lot of industry, buzz right now. It's very early days. But Citrix plans to play in all of these areas, and it's really about application delivery. And my personal vision, I mean, not necessarily Citrix's, but my personal vision is that, you know, we have an application delivery product, okay, that customer installs, and it does all of these, okay? You know, it's a configuration option whether you want to, you know, use a single user hosted desktop, you know, running in a VM, or whether you want to use Terminal Server, you know, shared session, or whether you want to use a dedicated system or published app or published desktop, or, you know, you want to stream the app or you want to manually install the app, whatever. We need to do it all, okay, and give the customer the choice. You know, they may use a combination of these different methods depending on who the end user is, or the app, or but they all have their place, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses, and it's really the combination of all of these that is very powerful, and Citrix is in a very unique position to execute on this.
And become the ultimate sort of Citrix application server.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, it's, you know, it's an application delivery server. You know, that really allow you to take control of your applications.
Well, with that, I won't take any more time from you, but I really, really appreciate Brandon taking the time with me right now, and this is really interesting stuff. I look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Yeah, no, it's fun talking here, and I hope we have future chats too.
Today's show is copyright 2006 by the Brian Madden Company. Thanks to Brand for taking the time, and thanks to you for listening. Tell your friends.